G'day, and welcome to the 2019 Fremantle Press podcast series. My name is Holden Shepherd, and I am the current winner of the City of Fremantle TAG Hungerford Award. My first novel, Invisible Boys, will be out later this year, but for the next few months, I'll also be your host. Today, I have the absolute pleasure of chatting with Anne-Louise Willoughby. Anne-Louise worked as a journalist in a career that spanned 30 years in Western Australia, first training as a newspaper cadet in the 1970s before moving to magazine publishing with Australian Consolidated Press. As a freelance journalist, she was a feature writer for Australian newspapers and contributing WA editor to Bell Magazine. Anne-Louise has worked as a lecturer and tutor in creative writing at the University of Western Australia, with a particular interest in memoir and biography. She lives in Fremantle, Western Australia. Anne-Louise, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Holden. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. So I'd love to dive right in and talk about the book. Nora Hyson, A Portrait, is so meticulously researched, and it's the first ever biography of a very important Australian artist. Of course, I was thinking there's lots of other artists you could have profiled. So can you discuss what drew you to want to tell Nora's story in particular?
I was first introduced to her work, but I thought it was by somebody else. I thought it was by Sir Hans Hyson, the great landscape painter. He was well known for his Federation era work, the great big landscapes with the Australian gum trees, the sheep going off into the distance, the drovers, people working on the land. But these works were different. And I thought, it's not a Hans. Who is it? And I happened to be with one of the family members, and as he was walking past this picture, I said, who is this work by? And he said, oh, that's Aunt Nora. And I thought, Aunt Nora? And later, and I'm embarrassed to say this, I discovered that Nora was the first woman to win the Archibald Prize. She was also Australia's first official female war artist. And I thought, why don't I know anything about this woman? And I thought that needed to be addressed.
Mm. And I mean, they are such notable achievements. So it is amazing that so many people haven't heard of this incredible artist. It's very much tied with what's on the introduction of the book. So I just want to talk about that because it opens with a description of Nora's 1945 painting, which is called Transport Driver, Aircraft Woman, Florence Miles. And this painting also appears on the back cover. And I feel like this image is quite representative of Nora as an artist, but also maybe what you were trying to achieve by raising the profile of this artist. Could you talk a bit about that image?
The image of the truck driver is a very strong image. And a lot of the art historians and the curators suggest that this image is actually Nora. Her attempt to portray the women who had joined the forces in the Second World War was to show strong women at work. They're still feminine, but they're powerful, they're committed, they're strong. She made an effort to put them into scenes that showed the work that they were doing and the contribution that they were making. These women are the embodiment of the strong side of the feminine, and that is a reflection of Nora, and we can see Nora in that image. And that's why I chose to write about it in the introduction to the book, because in a way it was my way of introducing the reader to Nora.
And this kind of ties into this, I don't want to say the big problem with Nora's legacy, but certainly there's this perception that she followed in the footsteps of her father. And even that, even saying that phrase kind of makes me go, oh, I don't know if that's the right phrase to use.
No, you're right. You're right. And it is a problem, and it was a problem for her. So the fact is that Nora, all of her life, wondered if she was living falsely, as if she were under the shadow of her father. And was she really a good artist, or was it because her name was Hyson? And for years she tried to separate herself from her father. In fact, after she returned from her studies in England, she decided there wasn't room at the Cedars. The Cedars was the crucible, if you like, of the family enterprise, the Hyson world. There were eight children. They lived in the Adelaide Hills in Harndorf in this magnificent 36-acre property. Hans Hyson drew a lot of his subject matter from around the house, and as did Nora when she was learning it at his side. But this close association with her father up until her early 20s, living at home and painting by his side, made that separation very difficult. Mm. She was written about as the clever painter daughter of the famous artist. Her gender was always an issue, and her heritage was always an issue. So it was a problem for her. And it wasn't until well into her 80s, or perhaps late 70s, in fact, where she finally was realizing that she was recognized in her own right. The dilemma here is that she was recognized outside of Heysen, but she couldn't see it. So, of course, that influenced the way she operated.
So I always like to include a reading from the book in these interviews. Do you have a particular part of the book you'd like to share today?
Well, I think the thing that's central to Nora's life in the early stages, and in fact all the way through, but perhaps demonstrated in this little piece that I'll read, is the tension between father and daughter, both artists. There was a time when, as a 16-year-old, there were visitors to Hans Heysen's studio, and they would be complimenting the great man on his latest work, and little did they realise it had just been done by his 16-year-old daughter. And Sally Heysen, who we haven't really touched on, who was the great promoter of Hans Heysen and his protector and marketer, she ran the enterprise of the Cedars as an industry almost, with all the visitors that came, the celebrities like Pavlova, Dame Nellie Melba, Sir Laurence Olivier and Vivian Leigh, Robert Menzies, Daisy Bates, Helen Keller. Sally Heysen had to protect Hans's work and didn't want it confused with the young daughter, because she didn't want it to be detracted from in any way, but she also was protecting the breadwinner. This is a big enterprise at the Cedars. There are 8 children and there's a lot to be looked after. So in this little reading, I talk about that moment.
Wonderful. The floor is yours.
Thank you. Sally's decision to move Nora into her own studio might have been to protect Hans, but it was beneficial for Nora that her aspirations were taken seriously at a young age. In Eggs, a painting done in 1927, the 16-year-old Nora demonstrates her understanding of composition and her affiliation with the everyday objects of domestic life at the Cedars, but her still lives were often at risk. The purloined objects she was painting could be requisitioned for the making of afternoon tea. She faced similar disruptions later in her own home when well-meaning assistance with tidying up meant a still life she had set up was inadvertently demolished or corked. Friends quickly learned to leave any arrangement remotely resembling a tableau well alone. Craig DuBerry, Nora's friend and carer in her later years when she lived alone in Hunters Hill, recalls Nora's eye for beauty in the most casual of moments. A bag of apples he'd left on a chair in the vestibule by the back door late one night became a beautiful pastel drawing by the time he went to get them the next day. And he recalls a half-eaten pawpaw that could not be finished until she had captured it on paper. She picked up on things that were natural, random, like someone had come in and placed them down without intent. She picked up on things like that immediately, said Craig. This spontaneity and affinity with the natural order of things is revealed in 1929, when, having completed a commissioned egg painting for Jacqueline White, Nora wrote in a letter accompanying the painting of the perils involved. Our hens have only just begun to lay again after an unusually long holiday, so I had to pounce on the eggs as soon as they were laid, before they were seen and gathered by Michael for kitchen use. I used to hear the fowls cackling from the studio and rush down to get the egg while it was still warm and had that exquisite bloom on it. Sometimes it was days before a special hen would lay the exact shade I wanted for my study. Nora's plans for her paintings were not only at risk from a cook in a hurry, but from a father who had helped train her eye for composition. Having meticulously set up a still life of onions to work on in her spare time, she returned it to start work after her week at art school had ended. She told Lou Klepak she was irritated to see that her father had set up his easel and had already painted them. Hans Hyacin was also prone to touches of insensitivity in his enthusiasm to guide his daughter. Nora was generous in her memory of him, despite finding charcoal corrections covering a freshly finished work. He genuinely tried not to influence me so I could try to develop my own style. Sometimes he couldn't resist, of course. I remember one day I left a painting of a basket of eggs in the studio, which I thought was pretty good, but when I came back, I found Father had drawn squares all over it showing where my draftsmanship was wrong. I was furious. Of course, he was right, but it took me a long time to see it.
And you've been listening to Anne Louise Willoughby reading from her book, Nora Hyacin, A Portrait. And I think that was such a great piece that illustrated some of that original, authentic voice that you mentioned throughout the book. Thank you so much for reading that.
Pleasure.
I guess for someone like me who knows very little about the art world, since Nora's passing, has her legacy and her father's legacy in the art world, has that changed? Has there been more of an emphasis on acknowledging Nora as her own artist, completely independent from her father's legacy?
That's a complex question in that posthumously both of them are now being celebrated independently and together.
Mm.
So at the moment there's a major retrospective hanging at the National Gallery in Victoria until 28th of July, in fact. And it's a very long hang, and it is the first exhibition of the two artists together.
Mm.
It is an important recognition of both of these artists. There was a period where the rise of modernism through the early 30s and 40s and 50s in Australia started to relegate the realist painters to one side. And by the late 60s, early 70s, Hans Hyacin and his kind of art was not in focus.
Mm.
And some people went so far as to say, even Robert Hughes, the art critic, went so far as to say he was, it was passé and this was not where Australian art was going. That said, in 1988-89, Nora was rediscovered by Lou Klepak, who is an art publisher and curator in Sydney. He went to visit Nora because he was working on perhaps an exhibition or a book about her father, and he thought he would go and see her and see what she could share about her father. When he got to her home, the chalet in Hunters Hill, he was amazed to see the extraordinary work of this woman who was alone, slightly impoverished circumstances, although she lived perfectly well. But the house was ramshackle, she was elderly, there'd been no repairs done on the house. But in a way, it wasn't because she didn't want that she wanted it repaired. Nora liked the natural order of things. She liked the way things aged. She was very happy with the patina of the wood, of the paint that was crackling and like you would in an old painting. In a way, she was living in an old painting. But he thought, this is strange, and said to her, why haven't you had a solo exhibition? She said, no one ever asked me.
Wow.
So Nora's problem was that she was not good at promoting herself.
Mm.
When she won the Archibald Prize, she just wanted the press to go away. Most people would use that as a platform to promote themselves and to build their career. The Archibald in 1938 assured a painter really of an income for the rest of their lives if they stuck at their portraiture because the commissions would continue to come. It was their entry point to the world of portraiture, and she did get commissions. But when she did win the Archibald Prize, it was very contentious. There were three artists in particular, fellow entrants, who criticised the win and said, this is outrageous. In fact, one fellow, Max Meldrum, thought it was an outrage. How could a woman possibly think that she could produce a painting good enough to win the Archibald Prize? Well, she had produced a painting good enough because the men, senior men in the art world, highly regarded, had chosen her as the winner. Another woman entrant, who I think was out of jealousy and some strange misguided view, that Nora should give back the prize money. Now, £400 in that time was enough for perhaps 2 years to sustain an artist, just to get on with their work. It was a lot of money. And Nora just said, well, that's nonsense. Art's art to me, no matter who does it, men, women or what. And she had no intention of giving back the money. I mean, this was the same woman who criticised Dobell's win 5 years later, his portrait of Joshua Smith. The question was it caricature or was it portraiture? And it ended up in court, and poor Dobell ended up having some suggest a nervous breakdown, and it changed the way he approached his career forever. It was a terrible situation. So just getting back to your question, the tension between father and daughter and also whether they're recognised or not, in 1989, Lou Klepek organised an exhibition for Nora, and she re-entered the public view, if you like. She'd always supported herself. She'd earned money from her art all through her life. Now she's in her late 70s, moving into her early 80s, and she's being recognised. And then in 1996, Mary Eagle from the National Gallery, there was a breakthrough purchase with London Breakfast for the National Gallery. Then the National Portrait Gallery followed, in heading towards the end of the 90s. And in 2000... there was a major retrospective of the National Library of Australia. Nora died in 2003. So fortunately, she did live to see her work fully recognised and right at the end of her life said, I think I am seen as an artist independent of my father.
That is a nice conclusion to have that kind of, I'm going to say, comeback tour, if you will, at the end of her career. But I'm so curious as to, I mean, for yourself following this story and kind of... researching this narrative, it would have been so much work to look at the early years, to look at the years of her success, and then to look at the years where she was not regarded. There's so much to go through. I'm curious as to, you know, your background as a journalist and having researched for many years, how did that come into play, and was that an asset in this process?
Yes, my training as a journalist, well, I was trained old school. I was a cadet in the 70s. There was no degree in journalism. It was rigorous. I had very tough editors and copy editors, and if there were mistakes, they'd eviscerate you. And
would they shout at you?
Occasionally from the glass square box where the subs would sit, you'd hear a lot of ranting and raving. You were hoping it wasn't being directed at your copy. But the chief of staff is usually on side, and he would run his eyes over your stuff before you put it in, and you hoped that it would, you know, pass muster. But that discipline and the fact that I ended up moving into research pieces, so long magazine style work, gave me an insight into my preferences and my skills, I suppose. There was a doggedness in my approach to my work, in that if I found something, I just had to find the next thing and the next thing, and how did that end up being that way? And I had to contextualize everything. Even if it didn't end up in the story, it informed the work. So at an early point, I knew that research was something that I enjoyed, and it was just as well, because I spent 3 years researching this book. I have spent hours in the National Library in Canberra and also in the archive in Harndorf. I've turned over clues. I have tracked people down. This work's taken me to Italy, to Hawaii. I found a missing son in Scotland that even the authorities couldn't find. And in fact, I had lunch with him. He came from Skye in Scotland, and we had lunch in Melbourne after the opening of the gallery, and because his father had become Nora's husband. And it was an interesting meeting to meet this person that nobody could find and hand him my book. It was quite a moment, actually.
That's incredible. I mean, just doing the research for this book, you've uncovered secrets, really, haven't you?
I have, and that's the way with biography. And for a biographer, you have to deal sometimes with uncomfortable truths, and they did keep me awake at night. But in consultation with the Heisen family, who authorised the book, I was able to navigate those uncomfortable things, and it was agreed that if you're going to write a life, you have to write that life, and you have to be careful. But they're covered.
Yeah, I mean, it would be difficult to make those choices and decisions of what to include and what to exclude. I noticed the book includes reproduction of some letters from Nora, from her husband Robert, and from her friend Jeffrey Smart, among others. And I would have imagined it would have been fascinating just poring over those, like, as you mentioned, in the archives and things like that. But I'm curious as to what the felt sense was like for you, you know, looking at these original documents from so long ago. And were there things that, as you kind of mentioned just then, were there things that you decided, I'm not going to include this, this is actually, it's better left out of the book?
There are so many beautiful things in the letters that I had to leave out. That was one of my sad... I mean, I could have written a Jane Austen kind of lookalike from the letters. They are just, they were so prolific in their exchanges. She would write at least daily and sometimes twice to Robert, often every second day or so to her family. You can track right down to what almost what she had for breakfast. But it was usually art was at the centre of all of these letters. But the way she wrote was the way I think she saw things. So her writing's very visual and descriptive, and I think sometimes what she was trying to convey, when you think about the mode of communication, when she was in London, for example, a letter could take a month to reach her father, but she'd be discussing a work that she'd been doing and then wait for his reply, for feedback. And, and so the speed of life was very different and the focus was very different. And through the letters, you see what's important to these two artists. And art for both of the Hysons was an all-consuming drive. There was no choice for them, just like breathing. They were compelled to put their brushes and their pens and pencils to paper or canvas. And again, going back to your question, there are things that are left out, but I didn't leave out anything that I believed contributed to the decisions that Nora made, the things that she decided to do that traced her life in a certain way. These are things that are personal, and when you are writing a biography, there's a point where you get into the psychology of your subject. You become to know them, you dream about them, you talk to them, you know how they're going to respond to something. That might sound a bit pretentious to say that, but you get to the point where you do have a sense of what they would also feel was important and what they would want to have said.
Yeah, and that certainly comes through. I mean, the part of the biography is not just about Nora, but also your journey to finding this information. So you do get that sense that you are, you know, almost looking through her eyes to see the world as she would have seen it.
Well, the letters provided fantastic dialogue, if you like, for the reader. It's Nora's words. She is saying what she wants her father to know, or her mother, or her sisters, and it's a marvellous resource that the National Library provides, and also the archive in Harndorf. And these letters are on public record. Anyone can go in and have a look at them.
One thing that you did include from those exchanges that kind of surprised me about Nora's life was this really extraordinary relationship with Stephen Khoury.
Oh, yes.
And I suppose it caught my attention on probably a personal level, given his sexuality. Can you talk a bit about this? Because I just found it so striking, and it was such an unusual arrangement, wasn't it?
It was an unusual arrangement. So Stephen was a neighbour, and in Hunters Hill, he wanted a kitten, and Nora was very well known for her cats, and she had some kittens, and he had come by to see Mrs. Black, as she was known, for a kitten, and they got talking, and he was an unusual boy in that he loved her garden. And they talked gardens for a long time. Her garden was very important to her because it provided her with the material for her paintings. She would go out, she would say, picking a flower is a prayer, and she would go and she would paint this flower and try and capture it in all its glory before it wilted. And although she loved the wilted ones as well, she was very bipartisan there. But getting back to Stephen, they became close friends. He started taking art classes with her. She didn't really have students, but he wanted to take, and she liked this young man. And gradually their friendship grew. When he was 17, the family moved to Tasmania. It was a trauma for him to leave Nora, and there were other movements that occurred within the family. And finally, he wrote to her and said, can I come and live with you?
Wow.
And she said, yes. Now, Stephen was gay. It was a difficult time for him in that his parents loved him, but I think they may have been struggling with his sexuality. And Nora, and this is a proposal that I put in the book, due to some very difficult things that she went through in her own life, I think she decided to take a position that she was absolutely non-judgmental. Mm-hmm. She would never judge someone, even if she were diametrically opposed to their view. She would listen to them, not necessarily or usually not take it on board, but she would never judge them or fight them on it. She had her position, you had yours, so be it. Mm. And Stephen and Nora had this wonderful understanding. She shared a great joy in his art, and in a way you'll see letters that the way her father mentored her, she mentored him. Stephen went to San Francisco because at the time it was a community that he could feel comfortable in, but it was also a tragedy because he eventually contracted HIV and he died of an AIDS-related illness. Mm-hmm. And that was a heartbreak for Nora. It was a deep tragedy, and he was an extraordinary young man.
It just sounds like a fascinating relationship, I'm so glad you included it in there.
It was pivotal for her. It had to be there.
Yeah, perfect. Something you did just mention was that Nora was referred to as Mrs. Black, and I found that very interesting because there was that whole theme of, you know, being in that legacy of and in the shadow of the Hyson name, and she, in fact, could have used her married name.
Yes, she could have, except there's a bit of a problem there. Nora fell in love with Captain Black. He was a tropical medicine specialist in New Guinea, but he was married. So in the 40s, that was a very difficult scenario. It was very difficult for the Hyson family. It was not in their constitution.
Yes.
And
frowned upon.
Well, it was just so difficult. It was just not something that happened in good society, if you like. Mm. But Nora was determined, and they were together for 10 years, I think, before they could marry. A divorce was very long in coming. Robert had a young wife and a young son, and it was a very difficult period. But they were in love and they committed to each other. But by the time she married, she was 42. She'd had a successful career as a young artist for 20 years.
Mm.
Changing her name to Black was really not a good idea at this point. She was stuck between the two men that were the most important to her, but she just stayed with the name Hyson. She did use Mrs. Black socially, and her mail and was addressed to Mrs. Black and Mrs. R. Black. But sadly, despite her devotion, her husband, after 20 years, had a relationship with a younger woman, his nurse, and left Nora heartbroken and married Gail Black, who was with him until he died. But it's very important to note that apart from his personal relationships, Robert Black was very important in the fight against malaria, and his work is acknowledged worldwide as being a breakthrough. In World War II, the biggest issue for the soldiers in the Pacific was malaria, not the Japanese.
Oh, wow.
Yes, they were losing more to malaria and dengue fever than they were to the enemy. So something had to be done, and Robert Black and the tropical medicine team set up by the Australian Army was instrumental in finding a treatment for that.
I guess we're saying he's not all a bad guy. Is that what
not at all. And I think we have to remember to view all of this through the lens of the day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking of the lens of the day, that's just a great segue, thank you. you mentioned that Nora claimed she would rather be a priest than a nun, and she was noting the difference between the genders and those gender roles at a very young age. And taking into account her life's work, breaking into and triumphing in this very male-dominated industry, especially with what you mentioned about the Archibald Prize and all the challenges she faced there. Do you think Nora is an unrecognised feminist icon?
So, yes, she could very well be, but she would hate that. Nora.
Sorry, Nora.
Yes, no, Nora would always yell quite stridently, "I am not a feminist." Well, Nora, I'm sorry. what you are, whatever your definition or leanings are towards the idea of feminism, let's just say that Nora was a strong woman. She was determined. She didn't see gender bias. Even when she was at school in London at the Academy and she was doing beautiful work, and yet the men, in fact, Bernard Meninsky said to her teacher, he said, "If you've been taught to draw the wrong way, and when you learn to draw properly, perhaps you can do Meninsky drawings." And she was just like, "I beg your pardon." But she said, "Oh, all right. Well, he knows he's the senior man, and maybe my work's not very good and I just need to work harder." And I put that, wouldn't it be interesting to have put her pictures up with no names, like a wine, do a blind tasting,
yes,
and see if the men could pick the female work, because her work was outstanding. There was no reason for this shocking criticism that she received when she was young. But interestingly, as we're talking about the feminist issue, she never saw the gender bias. Mm. She just thought, "Oh, these are men that my father has sent me to. They're respected. They know stuff about art. I need to listen to them and I need to work harder."
Mm.
Nora just worked hard.
Yes.
She wasn't anybody's cause, but she kept breaking ceilings. She was, as we said, the first to win the Archibald. She was the first official war artist. When she received her commission as a captain in the army, she was the first woman to receive equal pay to a man. So she was always at the forefront without meaning to be. She was just doing her thing.
Yeah, and I think maybe that's in doing these things, she actually kind of did shatter those glass ceilings, as you say.
Yeah, she broke barriers and shifted people's perceptions, but she wasn't aware of it. All she wanted to be was to be known as an artist, not a woman artist.
Yeah.
And that was her driving thing. It was all about the work, not about her.
I think it's a power in itself. I think it's really impressive. Mm. You write that you hope your book helps to redress the historical biases that have shadowed women's contributions. This is a totally loaded question, but do you believe there is still more work to be done in this area, and not just in the art world, but, you know, beyond?
Oh, absolutely.
I said it was loaded, so.
I know. Well, I think it's almost rhetorical, yeah. But I think that what we are seeing now is many attempts to address biases. I think that there is a greater platform for women to have a voice. I think the conversation is getting louder, and without being militant or strident at all, it just has to happen.
Mm.
It's a no-brainer. This sort of relegation of the female to a secondary position is just, it's a non-event. It has to just shift.
Yeah, and I think you know, as you said, we're seeing that shift around us, and I feel like this book is a contribution to that shift as well, particularly in the art world. It would be remiss of me not to pick your brains while you're here,
right?
Because I know that you teach writing at UWA, and you would see, you know, some of the triumphs of this generation of emerging writers coming through, and you'd also see some very common failings, I imagine. So I'm an author myself. I imagine there's authors listening to this podcast now. I'm wondering, can you just share some wisdom with me? Like, what do we need to know? What are we doing wrong? Please help me.
Look, I think one of the... Well, we could get a grip on some grammar. That would be great. Look,
is that the journalist in you?
Well, I'm afraid it is. It's the editor in me. But I am so privileged at the university with the young writers that I work with. I am inspired every time I walk out of the classroom. I'm like, wow. I think that I'll use an example. I wrote a story on how to start an art collection years ago, and I was very fortunate where I was able to interview Sir James Carruthers. Now, the Carruthers collection sits at the Lawrence Wilson Art Gallery, and I had worked with, I'll call him Jim because I was privileged to do that, and on a number of other projects. And when I went to ask him, you know, tell me how you start an art collection, and he said, well, don't start it as an investment. Collect things you love. Mm. So if I could say to a writer, don't look at this as an exercise in getting published, if you like, or being able to make an investment to earn a living, even though some would say, are you crazy? Start with something that you love, that really inspires you. I have to tell you, I really had to love Nora to stay with her for 5 years. I'm ready to have a little kind of rest, but she still sits with me. So I really like Nora Hyson. You really need to like what you do or love what you do or have a deep interest in it, and the writing will flow from that, and handle your grammar, guys.
Yep. Get it right.
It just helps with the flow, and, you know, you can, I always say, read your work out loud, and if you can't breathe, maybe you drop in a comma somewhere or perhaps even a full stop.
I feel like you'd hate some of the stuff I write in my first drafts. I always just find these like 50-word long sentences, and I think that's really bad.
Well, it's not bad at all. It's you putting it down on the page, and that is the hardest thing.
Mm.
Starting.
Yes.
And my words are just start. See where it takes you.
But then put a full stop in the middle somewhere.
Yeah, somewhere along the lines.
Awesome. Anne-Louise, I'm curious as to, with the book now out, what's the next project for you? Do you have someone in mind to research and to profile? Or
I do. I am working on a piece of narrative nonfiction. I'm not going to call it biography, but at the centre of it is a Texas cowboy. I was in...
Awesome.
Yes, I was in the hill country in Texas near Kerrville in 2009 when Barack Obama's inauguration was occurring. So this sits in the story of this extraordinary man who was 83. I was very lucky to spend some time with him on his ranch. But it sits on the land of the traditional owners. Mm. So we've got a multi-tiered narrative of hope with Barack Obama, of immigration of this German family to Texas, of the traditional landowners, and also of the Mexicans who work on the ranch who swim across the Guadalupe every February when it starts to thaw, when, well, the river doesn't freeze, but when the weather starts to turn to spring and the ranchers are needing their help, and that symbiotic relationship where the families of these Mexican workers with the rancher, he depends so heavily on them, and they have such an important role that I'd like to explore that.
I think that's a really interesting angle, and it's very timely given the narratives around immigration at the moment.
Well, yes, it's a book that I had already started my research on before we had Trump politics, and now there's a heaviness that's attached to the book in my mind that I'd like to see where it goes and perhaps elevate the people that deserve elevation.
That sounds super important, and I wish you well with the new project. In the meantime, Nora Hyson, A Portrait, is available now from Fremantle Press. And Louise Willoughby, it has been such a pleasure chatting to you today. Thank you so much.
It's been lovely. Thank you, Holden.